I'm very happy now to welcome Gisela Genschow. She's director of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet School, and Caroline Soloway is a student in that school, and the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet student recital will be at the Lensic this coming Sunday, the 26th of March at 1 in the afternoon, and then again at 6 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, tell us, what will we be seeing? Is this a performance of pieces that we might have heard of? Is it Aspen Santa Fe pieces? Or?
No, we usually create pieces that, for the specific group of students we have, that works for them. I like to do the program where we start with all the younger kids and go on through the ages, through the different levels, because that shows their progress really nicely. So we're not doing any repertory this year, but each teacher is developing a piece for the level of the students so they can shine on stage.
So basically you sort of have like the littlest ones come out first and then the bigger ones and the bigger ones and then your group, Caroline.
Yes.
So what kind of music, for example, are you using?
I personally use some music. I choose some Brahms waltzes, mm-hmm. which I have done for my three advanced girls. Two of them, like Caroline, are graduating and leaving the school, so that's always kind of bittersweet. And I'm using music from Greek, from the Pergin Suite for younger kids. I'm using Joseph Strauss, and I'm using Saint du Ballet also.
So let's talk about, I mean, there are probably many people who are listening who have seen the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet on stage at the Lensic, and it's definitely a beautiful and impressive company. When you teach, are you teaching the style that will be used for the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet dancers? The style, in other words, the style that they do?
No, you know, all the dancers are trained classically. Especially Aspen Santa Fe Ballet dancers are trained that they do also point work. It's not a modern company, you know. So everybody who has that kind of training is able to develop different styles. Yeah, that's what ask of dancers today. But if you don't have impeccable classical training, you're not going to really make it in a professional field, I think.
Even as a modern dancer?
Modern implies probably that you don't do point work. And still, ballet background is very helpful for the lines, for the posture, for the strength.
Gisela, you are from Germany. What was your own training like?
I was trained at the Hamburg Staatsoper, which also is, you know, a classical company. But we had other categories. We had modern, and it had some national, some folk dancing, some character dancing, how that's called. I think I really like that.
Were you trained by? I feel like in Europe everybody was trained by strict
yes,
Russians.
Yes, I had a very strict Russian teacher too, Viktor Kzovsky. He's very famous.
And how has the training of young dancers changed since you were a young dancer?
Really has not that much. You know, ballet is a very traditional art form, and we still performing pieces that have been danced many, many years ago with the same technique. So, but of course the understanding of how the body works and cross-training like yoga and Pilates has really come into the field of ballet too. So a lot of dancers get very stronger through these other disciplines.
Are they less likely to get injured by doing these other disciplines?
Yes.
Caroline's nodding. You do all sorts of physical training?
Yeah, actually, especially while I was injured at, I guess, first semester this year, I did a lot of Pilates, and that helped me maintain strength, I guess, while I couldn't take technique classes every day. So that was really helpful.
So when did you start dancing?
I started dancing when I was 7 at Aspen Santa Fe Ballet.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so I've been here for a while.
For, what, 10 years?
Yeah.
And so, did you know once you started that this was really a path for you?
I guess I just started because my parents put me in ballet after I liked the Nutcracker. And then I continued, and I just kind of developed a passion for it rather than it coming to me right away.
And you've been doing it now for all of these years, and have you considered whether that's your life path, whether you are going to become professional?
I don't think that that's the path for me because of, I mean, you have to have incredible feet and this body type. And I guess I just don't have that in that, I guess, discouraged me from a younger age from considering that as heavily. But I would like to continue in college. And I mean, it's such a big part of my life, even if it's not my career. So,
right.
Yeah, just doing that while I'm studying would be wonderful.
And you're going to Barnard College next year.
Yes, I'm really excited about that.
Congratulations
to you.
Now, this whole thing of having the right body type and having the right feet and all of that. I mean, I remember as a kid, the pain and suffering of trying to get your feet to stretch and turn out and all of that stuff. And it seemed that, I mean, I remember going off into the New York City Ballet and all the dancers were virtually the same size, the same type, and almost the choreography almost needed people who looked exactly alike in order to do it. And it seems to me, having seen ballet, at least at the Lenzic, and I mean, I haven't traveled to big cities so much since then, but it seems like there's more room for different kinds of people.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. But if you look in a classical company, too, if you see, for example, Giselle, and you see the second act, all the girls who are dancing the Willys, they should look all the same. I mean, that's the big asset of these big companies, Russian companies. But nowadays, we have such a varied repertory, and a lot of the more contemporary pieces demand much more personal expression than just having the right body. So there is room for everybody.
Very interesting. So another part of training that didn't exist when you were young, when I was young, was things like videotapes. Do people videotape themselves and then look at that and self-correct? I mean, back in the old days, it was just mirrors.
Yeah, no, we could do that, but at this point, we don't. We just still use the mirrors, but it's definitely a good tool, but I haven't used it.
It can be a bit brutal sometimes.
To watch yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, right. So the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet School takes kids from the youngest age, and I was looking at the website, and it seems the first level wears this color leotards,
yes,
and then the next level. And so it's a certain kind of very strict discipline is what it looks like.
Yeah, that's part of, you know, what we're teaching in ballet. Discipline, self-discipline. No, perseverance, that's part of this, comes just with the package.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the youngest kids are 3 years old. We've taken them at 3 years old. And we have the pre-ballet program that goes from ages 3 to 7. And then they continue in ballet.
What can they do from 3 to 7? I mean, their bodies are so... they're just toddlers.
Yeah, I have a fantastic teacher, Karen Bretschneider, is specialized at this age group, and she is really wonderful of teaching them tools. Like at the beginning, it's just knowing about the space, about music, different colors. And Kellen can maybe tell you a little bit because she has assisted the teachers with the younger kids.
Yeah, for the past 2 years, I've actually been helping Karen, which has been really fun. Last year, I had 4-year-olds, and this year, 7. And I think the 4-year-olds learn a lot about discipline, just how to sit down and do what they're asked, which is actually kind of rare to find in a 4-year-old. So, yeah, I think they've learned a lot in even 1 year of ballet without learning the ballet steps, I guess you could say.
Right, right. Has doing ballet affected the rest of your life? I mean, are you more disciplined about homework or whatever for other things?
Definitely. I think I'm kind of a work first, play later kind of person. So it's really taught me a lot about dedication and perseverance. I mean, sticking with it for so long has really been valuable. So, yeah.
Now, the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet School, there's actually a couple of schools in different locations, is that right?
Yeah, we have 2 schools. One of them is in Aspen, and our school here in Santa Fe.
Oh, okay.
Right.
And if anybody wants to find out more about that, they can go to the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet website. The Aspen Santa Fe Ballet student recital is this Sunday at the Lenzic at 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock. That's kind of a marathon for you guys.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We also have a lot of folklorico students. We're running a program in the public schools, which is an after-school program. learning about Mexican folk dance, and the students who work at the schools are also included in our recital.
Oh, wonderful.
It's going to be very colorful and beautiful.
The costumes and
yes,
the whole thing.
Yes, it's really lovely.
And for the ballet part of it, the classical ballet part of it, what kind of costumes are you wearing?
I have a lot of tutus this year, actually. It's the first time in a while that I've had so many tutus, but...
And yeah. Do you do partner work? I mean, do you have enough boys to have the pas de deux type of thing?
Yeah, actually, my partner is my friend's brother who's been dancing all of these years. So, yeah, he's really trained well, and it'll be good. I'm excited.
Karen Soloway is a ballet student. Gisela Genschau is director of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet School. For tickets, you can call the Lenzic box office 988-1234. And you can just go to the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet website to find out more about Aspen Santa Fe Ballet and the school. Gisela Genschau and Caroline Soloway, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Beth Kennedy Jones. She will be singing the Julie London Songbook along with the Burt Dalton Trio at the Cantina at La Casa Cena this coming Sunday and Monday, May 26th and 27th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's always great to have you here. You do so many different things. You're an actor and a singer and director too, right?
I do.
And so last time you were on the show, you were directing a theater piece called Salt and Pepper, and there's going to be a full production of that coming up.
Yeah, we did the stage reading, and it was extremely well attended. Had to turn away 30 people, I think all because they listened to your program. Okay, but it went very well, and then they did a stage reading the next month in New York City. So they're doing a full production in New York in the fall, and we are doing a full production here in the fall, and they're doing one in Dixon next month, actually. So it's done very well.
Good. Well, we hope to talk about that just a little more when the time comes. But let us talk now about Julie London. Talk about languid, sultry, beautiful voices. And, I mean, as a human being, as a woman, she was an amazingly charismatic actress and singer. Have you always loved her?
You know, I think I always loved her, though I didn't know who she was. Because when I was approached by Stars Never Fade to be Julie London, I really had to do some research. And then I recognized that the way that I have sung Cry Me a River since I was much, much younger was the way that she sang it. And it is different. In fact, she even changes some words around. Those were always the words that I was using. So I'm sure that it was being played in my household. I was very, very young, so I don't remember, and I don't have any parents to ask them. But I think that she was in my life, you know, and certainly songs like Girl Talk and Wives and Lovers, I mean, they were just around. But I did not connect with Julie London, never saw the TV show Emergency. But it's been great doing the research because I've really gotten to know her and to know Bobby Troup and to fall so much in love with both of them.
She has a voice that reminds me of a really mellow tenor saxophone.
She would have loved to hear you say that. I mean, she really did think of her voice as an instrument. She never thought of herself as being a strong singer, but she did definitely know that she had a style. And she liked to, you know, she was absolutely intimate with her singing. And she liked to sing, and I say this in the show, that she liked to sing the spine of the song. And I love that because my background is all method acting, and so I really like to get inside the song and tell it as a story. And although I think at one point I had a stronger voice, now I really love creating this mood, this piece that's going on when you're singing. You're creating a moment in time.
Now, the spine of the song, what does that mean?
Well, vocally, to sing, you know, if you took everything else away, you took all the embellishments away from a song, whether it's the instrumentation, whatever, it's like, what is that song truly about? You know, you could say, oh, it's a blues. It's, yeah, but there's so many reasons behind singing the blues. So is it misery? Is it this love of being unhappy? Is it the fact that you actually felt something within that moment and it was so exciting to feel, to be to be have your passion driven. So it's like each song has a different reason for being, you know, if it's a song of any value.
I was reading an article recently that described a television program that I don't watch. It was one of those talent search kinds of programs, and I believe it was Harry Connick Jr. basically reamed out all of these young singers because they didn't understand what they were singing.
Yeah. Well, there's a producer that I work with in New York. She's been singing her entire life, has written a great many musical shows, events, things like that. And she says to her students, the first thing you do is you sit down and you read the words.
Right.
Read them and get an understanding of what you're doing. Don't put any music to it. And then you come out of that space. And for me, for each song, I write a story. You know, it's like a backstory for every song.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Give us an example of that.
Well, Cry Me a River. You know, there's, it's, I'm trying to remember the movie that it's used in, The Girl Can't Something. It's used, and there's a storyline in that. But I use it for a specific relationship that I build for why I would then want to sing this song to someone, literally telling them, oh, really, you know, you think you're hurting, I really, really hurt, and you weren't there for me, and you didn't understand. But I write out, I mean, I give my characters names and location, and that song for me takes place in New York City, and it involves certain people. And when, you know, she says, told me love was too plebeian, you know, and I...
Is that a lyric in the song?
Yeah. It's really interesting because the song was actually written by Arthur Hamilton for Pete Kelly's Blues, which was a film that was being produced by Julie London's first husband, Jack Webb. And Jack Webb turned to Arthur Hamilton because he was having Ella Fitzgerald sing the song in the movie. And he said, you know, I really can't see Ella Fitzgerald singing the word plebeian. So...
Well, I wonder why not.
I think
because she was such a natural aristocrat.
I don't know, the time something. So Arthur Hamilton said, "Okay, fine, I'm gonna rewrite the song." And he tried. He tried for several days to rewrite the song without using the word plebeian. Came back to Jack Webb and said, "You know what? I can't do it. That's the word." So Jack Webb did not use it in the movie. And then Julie London was recording her first album. She knew this story. She went to Arthur Hamilton, who had been her high school buddy and beau, and said, I'd like to record this song. And he said yes, and it ended up being her signature song and, you know, put her on the top of the charts for months and months and months, you know. So it's interesting that the word plebeian would be the reason behind that. But so I really do write a whole backstory, and I fill in all the colors so that when I'm delivering that song, it's not just the music, which I can't fill out with all sorts of, you know, vocalese. You know, I think it would be very different if it was that.
Right.
So it's hopefully within that moment I can draw the audience into my world, because that's what is so much fun.
When you were on stage singing, I've always wanted to ask somebody this. What are you thinking about? Are you totally in the moment and not thinking at all? Are you thinking about technique? Are you feeling the story of the person who is sad? I mean, what's going on in your head and your heart?
Well, it's different times. Sometimes just being petrified, hoping I'm going to be remembering all the words. When I was doing Company, I totally went up on a song while I was performing. I mean, totally went up to the point where I came backstage and somebody said to me, I've never heard that song sung in Norwegian before. I mean, I just like stuffing that. So sometimes it's just trying to remember the words. But the ideal situation is that you're completely immersed, or I'm completely immersed in the song at that moment, in the story that I'm telling. And having the joy of, I mean, music is spectacular. Singing, to be an instrument at that moment, where it's not only you're doing notes, you're also doing words. To be immersed in that is fabulous. I mean, I think it's the feeling of it, you know. So I'd say that's the ideal. Other times I'm thinking vocally because I know that there's some changes and I want to make sure that I go from what I might call my chest, more my head voice, and making sure I just the mechanics of it, so that I'm lightening up a little bit on the pressure that I'm putting in my lower voice, so that when I go into my upper notes, I can glide into them, and there's no sound of what would be considered a break. So sometimes there's that technical end, but if I've done enough rehearsal, then I'm not really concerned about that within the moment, and I'm just in the song. And also listening to the musicians. I mean, Burt Dalton, Milo Jaramillo, and John Trent Acosta playing behind me. I mean, part of the joy of it is just listening to them play.
We love them.
Yes, we love them.
And we hear them on KSFR.
Yes.
On a fairly regular basis.
Yes.
Do you know, like, when you have those magical moments where it's all working and everything comes together artistically, do you know it in the moment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because... So much so because the audience tells you,
yeah,
which is so wonderful, you know. And I'm not funny, but I do joke. And so when you feel the humor coming back at you with people getting it and enjoying their moment of kind of laughter, that's really great. And also when you touch people emotionally, when you see somebody in an audience that's actually moved to a level of emotion, whether it's crying or you can just see it in their eyes, that you've touched another human being. I mean, that's a really fabulous feeling.
We're talking to Beth Kennedy Jones about the upcoming Julie London performances. Now, let's go back to Julie London for a moment. She had an interesting life. She married a couple of times. She had a lot of kids. She lost a number of children.
Yeah, later on. She had five of her own, two with her first marriage, and then three with Bobby Troup. But Bobby Troup brought two children to the marriage, so there were seven altogether. But, I mean, she didn't have a life of tragedy, or certainly not a life of scandal. You know, she was really, this was a living for. And this is one of the things that I talk a lot about in the show, because the show, I'm singing, but there's also some video components, and there's biography. I do it from the first person. So I'm talking about the different influences in my life, what made me sing the songs that I did, where I went. And a big part of it is that she was doing it to make a living. And she was not a performer in the sense that she didn't love to perform. Bobby Troup loved to perform. She did not. She was usually petrified every moment that she was singing. But it was able to help her afford to have her children and her home. And that's, you know, that's the story of a lot of us. You know, we're doing certain jobs that might not always be what we want to do, but we need to do it in order to do the things we want to do. And that was a big part of her life.
Yeah. Called being a working artist.
But I mean, there's some performers that are out there that they are living to perform. That was not her story.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, the Julie London songbook, we're not talking about songs that she wrote, but it was the songs
that she loved
to sing and was known for. And they're by a variety of different composers.
Yeah, I mean, I sing several songs by her husband, by Bobby Troup, but Sir Noel Coward and Cole Porter and Thelonious Monk. I mean, there's just a huge range. She actually did 32 albums. So she has sung a lot of songs. Usually Stars Never Fade, which is the company that's producing this, that's what they call their different shows. Like last month it was Kenneth Brown sings the Andy Williams songbook. The month before it was Peggy Lee, but it was the Peggy Lee songbook. So it's their songs that they're known for, and also what I try to do in this show is really show the different kinds of songs that she does. Some people just think of her in terms of, you know, Cry Me a River, and that's just the blues, but she also sang, you know, Desafinado and Sway and very up-tempo and fun things. So,
which you will be doing as well.
I will. I love those songs.
Do you have any favorites?
Well, Cry Me a River is definitely a favorite, and Round Midnight. And I love Sway and Desafinado. But Fly Me to the Moon, you know, and she starts out, she got into a routine that she started out every show singing Bye Bye Blackbird. And she does that just with the bass player, and it's just really fun. And she was really, her favorite time to sing was about 2 a.m. in her house. Bunch of musicians would be over because she and Bobby had all these friends, and they would just be playing and she would start singing. That was her favorite kind of singing. So a lot of the things that she liked to do, like she did Cry Me a River with guitar, And then there were other times that she did with, you know, full orchestra. But I think that what she loved the best was, like, really playing with one or two or three other musicians. You know, so there's a range of songs, and there's a range of songs that I like to sing of hers. I think every song in the show I love to sing of hers. I did this show in July at the Playhouse. I've added four more songs to it because I wanted so much to sing those other songs.
Right, right. So talk about the Stars Never Fade production. Mm-hmm. So they're presenting all kinds of people, Julie London, as you say, Andy Williams, and what is it, one a month?
They usually do one a month. Next month they have Marilyn Monroe coming in.
from beyond.
From
the veil.
Beyond. In July, Danny Kaye. I loved Danny. I grew up loving Danny Kaye, you know. But he's going to do a show in...
Every single one of them are people we think of also as, you know, primarily perhaps as actors. Not Julie London so much, but...
Well, Catherine Donovan has done Rosemary Clooney. She was in Nita O'Day. John Trenacosta, who we talked about before, did the Gene Krupa show. He did that last August at the Playhouse, but he'll be doing it in December at the Cantina. They're always deceased, except recently they did the Patti Page show. Because she had not been seen for so long, they actually had thought that she had passed on. They did the show, and then she has passed on this year. She passed on a couple months later. But it's usually always people that it's Stars Never Fade. It's these people that we adore. I mean, they've done Janis Joplin. In August, they're going to do something called the 27th Club, which is, there's Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin.
People who died at the age of 27?
Yeah, the 27th Club.
Oh, my goodness.
Amy Winehouse, yeah. I guess you've not heard of the 27th.
I've never heard of the 27th. Is everyone else, ladies and gentlemen, heard of the 27th Club?
I think probably you might want to do like a little email blast to have people email you. Because I think, you know, it's like whatever that marijuana date is in spring, you know.
People 420.
Know.
Yeah.
Like, I forget the date, but I know it's there. Yeah. Jim Morrison. There are these artists, these singers that primarily rock and rollers died at 27.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough life.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, Julie London lived into her 80s, so her life is a little bit different.
Right. So we're talking to Beth Kennedy Jones about the Julie London songbook performance, which is coming up. Now, the Cantina at La Casa Cena, for people who've never been there, tell us what that is like as a performance venue.
Well, it's a club. So doing it at the Playhouse, where you're on a proscenium stage, is very different. Plus the people in the audience, they might have a, you know, cup of water or something. But at the Cantina, people come in, they can get something to eat, get a drink. And it's a real club atmosphere, which is what Julie London was known for, performing in small clubs. And the Cantina offers that. It has been offering that for 20-plus years at Casa Cena with its nightly performances with all the servers singing, which is great.
I love that.
I know. It's great. And all the people there, they're so talented. They have such a great time, you know, and Bob Fox on the piano. I mean, it's a great venue.
But you won't be serving dinner.
I'm not going to be serving dinner, but, you know, I'm wearing these very high heels, and I don't think anybody would want me to serve them anything.
Yeah.
They'd probably land all over them, I think, actually.
The high heels thing, that's also another Julie London.
I don't know if that was her thing. I think she was more comfortable in sneakers, but... on stage.
As everybody is.
But when she first started performing, she'd just perform in like just a black turtleneck and sitting on a stool. And again, this is this thing where I know that she influenced my life, even though I didn't know it was her, was that when I used to perform back in New York City, I used to always wear this Donna Karan black turtleneck, long sleeve outfit.
So you were channeling Julie London.
Yeah, and on a stool. And I can remember somebody coming and saying, everything was fabulous, wonderful, but you've got to wear, with your shape, you should be wearing these knockout dresses. And I think that's what Julie London was finally told. She had to wear some sparkle, so she got into that. So I have some sparkle. I have three different outfits I wear in the show.
Oh, so there's breaks and changes of costume.
Changes.
And so you're going chronologically through her life.
I do. I started the beginning, and I tell the story in first person, which is really fun. Which, when I first started working on her, I didn't want to do. It just seemed so presumptuous. But now I really like doing it. I like being her. I like that time period, just to totally be her.
So if Julie London is looking down from beyond the veil.
From the gods.
She's probably happy.
I hope so. I would want to do her justice.
Yeah.
Beth Kennedy Jones will be doing the Julie London Songbook with the Burt Dalton Trio on Sunday and Monday, May 26th and 27th. It's a production of Stars Never Fade, and the seatings are at 5:30, the performance is at 6, and I guess reservations are highly recommended.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And so for that, you can call 988-9232 here in the 505 area code. Beth Kennedy Jones, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Loved it, and I'd also suggest that people go to the Stars Never Fade website for more information. They'd like to.
And that is starsneverfade.com.
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you so much. And we're going to go out with Beth Kennedy Jones singing a song from the Julie London Songbook.
If I could only spend an hour with you, if I were free to do the things I'd like to, I want you to know I just couldn't go until I told you, honey, that I love you so. If I could be with you 1 hour tonight, if I were free to do the things I might, I'm telling you true, I'd be anything but blue if I could be with you 1 hour. If I could be with you.
I'd like now to welcome Jake Chiofalo. He is with the Santa Fe Waldorf High School and is directing the senior class production of the play Cheaper by the Dozen, and that's actually this evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Cheaper by the Dozen is actually a children's novel, I guess you would call it. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. It's a lovely book, and I know there have been some film adaptations of the book. This particular play, this adaptation, goes back to the original book, which is really sweet and humorous. Indeed, it comes from the perspective of two of the children that wrote the book. And so for our 12 seniors, I adapted this Cheaper by the Dozen, and they were thrilled by the title alone.
Oh, because you've got actually 12 seniors at the school?
12 seniors, absolutely, yes. Yeah. So that was very fitting for this particular play and the title.
This is a book that I have to say I remember reading when I was a little kid, probably in, I don't know what, sixth grade or seventh grade or something like that. And it was a very memorable book. I can still remember it in some detail because there was a very charismatic father who had these 12 kids, and I think he was an Irish immigrant or something like that. He was Irish, and he would take his kids and say, are my little Irishmen cheaper by the dozen? And I remember doing the math and thinking, well, if the oldest one is 13, were they really having kids every year so that they could bring them all out in a car together?
That's actually a very humorous point behind the story. It seems like they did have children every year, and as a matter of fact, when the mother when she would get sick, one of the children would obviously say, well, are you going to have another baby? No, I'm just have a sore throat. So it was that expectation that every year that a new child would come along.
Right.
And with the play itself, there's a baby that's being held by the mother as they're driving around in their jalopy and this sort of thing. So it is quite funny that she produced so many children, yes.
And this man, the father, was some kind of efficiency expert. I mean, the children who wrote this book, it really was based on a real-life character.
Right, that's a very good point. It's he was very well known for setting up efficiency methods in factories. And as a matter of fact, today, many of our methods that we have for time efficiency were a product of what he thought about back in the 30s and 40s and still in effect today. And so he applied these as well to his personal life, his family, which makes it quite humorous.
Right, trying to get his family and himself to do everything in the absolutely most efficient time span possible.
Correct.
Which runs kind of counter to the way that we're trying to live today, which is to slow down and enjoy the moment and not speed up our lives so much.
Right, quite the opposite. Everything was based upon, as you had pointed out, buttoning up shirts, how fast can you do it, how fast can you take a bath, and learn languages and master mathematics. And so he was pretty fond of saving time, yes, quite different than enjoying it, shall we say.
And so the play stars all 12 seniors at the Waldorf High School?
That is correct. They all have different parts, they've been really enjoying it. They've been working hard. And so I must say that the play is certainly about this wonderful family, but it's also about the sanctity of memories and how important they are. The children that wrote it missed their father, who died shortly after he had established some of his well-known aspects of implementing the factory system. And so the culminating act in the play is based on a senior prom where he is having to send his oldest daughter off to college. And how does he let go, and the trust that's involved with enabling her to fly from the coop, so to speak. And there's this mutual then trust in one another that they did fine, and she understands that his grasp on the family and the dynamics of the family was important, because he tried his best to take care of the family, but for some it was a little bit too tight of a grasp. But then ultimately they understood one another, and it's a beautiful conclusion.
So was it tricky to adapt this book to a play? Have you ever done that before?
I have. I've done that a couple of times. It's actually quite it's not only entertaining, but it's very important too, because I have the students in mind that play the different roles. So from my perspective, it works very well, because I can think about which student would most not only be suitable for a particular part, but come out the other end and realize, wow, that really happened in this play. And so there's a growth process that takes place through the entire play, from the beginning to the end. It's amazing to see how the students transform from the beginning to the end. They come out either more confident or ebullient, and it's wonderful to see. And that's why plays are a huge aspect of Waldorf schools, because of that aspect alone.
We're talking to Jake Ciafolo about the production of Cheaper by the Dozen at the Waldorf Santa Fe Waldorf High School, which is happening tonight. Do you ever make these adaptations available to other schools who might want to do the same play?
I haven't yet. No, this has been more of a personal endeavor for the students that I have. I hadn't. That hasn't crossed my mind, but certainly maybe a bridge to cross in the future. I'll give it some thought. We just did a 10th grade production of Ovid, and so I adapted some of Ovid's great writing to a play, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, that's a selection process.
It is, yes, indeed. But certainly, I have a great writer to work from.
That's
a joy in itself.
Tell us more about the Waldorf School. There's a very specific set of kind of principles and ideas that are behind all the Waldorf schools.
Yes, it's about a century old, the school itself, having been founded by Rudolf Steiner right after World War I. And he just felt there was a need for this kind of education that was it's very complex in a way, but in a nutshell, I would say that it's based upon the development of the child and bringing particular subjects at a particular time in the child's development. And this goes all the way through high school, that there's a time to bring chemistry, there's a time to bring math in terms of brain development, physical development. And another key aspect is there are no textbooks, and so it's not spoon-fed. They create their own books. So the idea of bringing in beauty and aesthetics and creativity into all aspects of Old Earth Education are vital, and that itself in itself is amazing to behold.
There are some kids who I've observed who just love doing the creative part and making their own books, and there are other kids who just hate it and they have to get their parents to help them, and they'd rather actually be doing math proofs on the blackboard and things like that. Does the Waldorf school kind of, like, I don't know, filter out the kids who don't like that kind of education? They tend not to even apply to the school?
That could be a part of it, but it's amazing that once the process gets started, they really get into it and they enjoy it and they feel proud of their work, and the end result is this beautifully illustrated textbook where they have their own illustrations and their own writing, and I think there's just a sense of pride that comes into place, and they feel like they want to complete it. And my opinion, going back to my own childhood, is that there's quite a relationship between creating something beautiful and having the momentum to finish work and complete it. And I think that's a big part of their striving to do well with making their own textbooks.
Jake Chiafalo is the director of the Santa Fe Waldorf High School production of Cheaper by the Dozen. It's the senior class production, 12 kids, 12
That's
cast
right.
members.
Very perfect.
And tell us when and where.
It is at the Santa Fe Performing Arts. That's 1050 Old Pecos Road. And 12 and under are free. And that's at 7 o'clock. And there's going to be a live swing band. And so it's certainly entertainment for the entire family.
And is that the Armory for the Arts?
Yes, it
on
is.
Old Pecos Trail?
That is correct.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Well, Jake Chiafalo, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we'll see you tonight.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Nate Downey. He's a permaculture landscape designer. He's the author of the book Harvest the Rain. And this Sunday, he is taking part in an event. It's called March Against Monsanto. It's starting at the Santa Fe Farmers Market at noon, and they're marching to the Roundhouse. Welcome, Nate, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a very exciting week.
Well, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, we just had a show this week about Edible City, which is all about urban
yes.
farming and what the big food problem is in this country. And part of it is companies like Monsanto. Why are you marching against them?
Well, Monsanto is essentially trying to corner the food market on some level with creating seeds that only they can sell, that they're patented, that then they sue farmers who end up having them on their property, sometimes by accident.
Yeah, blowing with the wind.
Yeah, yeah. And they also have a really long history of a poor track record in terms of health. The Agent Orange from Vietnam, which poisoned so many people. Roundup, which is the world's biggest herbicide, all over North America and elsewhere, creating tumors, causing birth defects. They're the makers of dioxin and PCBs. And they, yeah, and that's the beginning. There's a bovine growth hormone and all these untested products that end up in our bodies. And the next big thing for them is the GMOs, genetically modified organisms, which the European Union, Australia, and others are banning right and left.
You can't, as far as I understand it, you can't get genetically modified food in Europe. I mean, that they won't sell
it. I think Spain and Romania, for some reason, are, you know, where you actually, Monsanto has been able to get in there. And I'm not exactly sure of all the other countries, but I recently read that those are two exceptions. But France has been very adamant lately. And the UK was, I think, the first country to really say, hey, wait a minute. The FDA never approved this stuff. And just because it's coming out of America, what the FDA said was that as long as you say it's healthy, it's fine with us for you to sell it.
As long as the company says it's healthy.
As long as you, these days, now we have to, the person, right? Because
yeah.
it's supposedly a person, according to Citizens United decision. But, right, the company can say it's healthy, and the FDA will just go ahead and agree.
So I can grind up bicycle parts and mix it with compost and coat it with chocolate and say that's healthy and the FDA will approve it?
If your name is Monsanto, probably. Now, it's partly because a lot of the people who are doing the regulating, especially early on in the evolution of all this, the cronies that would be appointed were assigned to say, let Monsanto do what it wants. And there's a lot of people at the FDA who've been trying to get the word out about this, but oftentimes they're silenced and aren't allowed to do so. So there's a huge element of just political corruption that if people, say, aren't really, for some weird reason, interested in the food issue, they should be interested in the corruption part of this and the fact that this Saturday is a great opportunity to exercise your democratic right, to get out and get people to hear us cheer for a better way of creating food in this country and the world.
So there are over 400 marches happening all over planet Earth of the same kind.
At the same time.
Is it the same time?
Well, okay, I don't know if they're doing it in
Brisbane. I was going to say,
they're doing it at midnight or whatever, right?
At noon, whatever their time zone is.
Maybe that's what it is. Thank you. Yeah, and you can go to marchagainstmonsanto.com. And look, and it starts with Africa, and it's got all the ones in Africa, right? And it goes down. There's like 22 in the state of New York. There's 3 in New Mexico now, Albuquerque, Silver City, and Santa Fe.
What do you hope to accomplish? I mean, Monsanto isn't going to look at these marches and say, oh, okay, I think we'll just declare ourselves a new company now and stop doing that stuff.
Right. That's a great question. One of the things that might be accomplished is, from what I understand, the Monsanto Protection Act was passed by Congress, but Obama has not yet signed it. Now, if he sees enough complaints, maybe he'll actually take another look and veto that. I very much doubt that. And I'm sure it's sort of in his old box to sign before the pocket veto kicks in. He's unfortunately nominated and gotten various people who are part of the whole Monsanto FDA ring to be part of his administration as well. And so maybe he misinterpreted the tea leaves years ago when this was sort of his decision to make, and maybe he'll say, wait, let's change our course. But current course of the administration is to continue what the Bush administration did and the Clinton administration did and the previous Bush administration did, which is basically let these rich companies that are involved in our food system do what they want. And it's time for us to say no.
The March Against Monsanto is starting at the Farmers Market this Saturday, May 25th at noon. There's a march to the Roundhouse, and there will be signs for people who want to carry them, or they can bring their own signs or their own T-shirts or their own tambourines or whatever people would like to do. And Nate Downey is a permaculture landscape designer, author of Harvest the Rain. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.